welcome to it, the Daily Daily Caller Podcast for this, the 6th day of June 2019, D-Day plus 75 years. I'm going to spend quite a bit of time talking about D-Day at the end of the program, but we're going to catch up on all the news of the day first. I'm Derek Hunter. I'm your host. Thank you for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Please keep sharing this on social media and tweeting it around and Facebooking it and all those good things. It only grows because of you, and we are growing, so that's what I owe you, is a huge debt of gratitude. You can email me, Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com, compliments, complaints, whatever you got. I'll take all comers. I enjoy reading the emails. I thank you for the nice emails today, and the other emails, a lot of disagreement about my assessment yesterday about Scott Peterson, the cowardly police officer down in Broward County. We have to agree to disagree. I'm not going to just tell you what you want to hear. I agree with you now. Please keep listening. No, I think you listen because I tell you what I really believe. It's easier to remember. There you can find all the other podcasts out there that'll tell you focus grouped stuff and gangs of people. It's amazing to me how many shows have multiple people on them. Can't you carry a show by yourself? Anyway, lots of things to get to, as I said, and it's kind of in the context of D-Day. And the overriding theme of the day is the overriding theme of my piece, my column up on Town Hall today, is have we really forgotten the message of D-Day, the sacrifice of D-Day? I have long held the belief that we could not win World War II today. Not because we don't have the military might to defeat any army on the planet. We certainly do. We don't have the will to do it. We have 40% of the country who would immediately identify in a sympathetic way, if not an active way, with enemies of this country. The people who, after 9/11, said, what did we do to deserve this? What we really need to look at ourselves and figure out how this came about. I knew a girl. I'd just moved to Baltimore a few months earlier. I moved to Baltimore in June of 2001, working in Washington, D.C., taking the train down every day. And after September 11th, I got into an September 11th was on a Tuesday, and by Friday, a friend of mine that was a friend of my friend who lived in Baltimore already and I got into an argument over AOL Instant Messenger. And I'd had enough. I was done. She really believed that we had it coming for 9/11. I knew she was liberal, but I didn't really know anybody. I hadn't been here that long. So all the people I knew at work were, an hour away, and I didn't own a car because I couldn't afford a car. So I was kind of stuck with the friends that I kind of inherited, and they were all very liberal. But this one in particular believed that we had it coming. And her view was not unique to her. Nothing about her was unique. Nobody is unique, by the way, but she bought it. She thought that, well, what did we have to do some soul searching and whatever it was that set these people off, that upset these people to this point? We have to make sure we don't do, we have to stop doing that. We should probably apologize for having done it, and then maybe they're better angels. We can appeal to their better angels, and they won't do it again. And that pissed me off. Especially like right after September 11th. Now I could just look at somebody who's crazy and ignore it. But back then we got into an argument and I never spoke to her again. Never again. I don't know what happened to her. She was a nurse or a nursing student or something like that. And never heard word one from her. She lived a couple blocks away and I couldn't care less. But that mentality is more widespread now than it even was back after September 11th. And it was pretty widespread after September 11th. So I don't think there is any way we could defeat an enemy of this country because we have so many enemies of the country in the country. And we welcome more and more every day. And we create more and more every day with massive student loan debts to accompany them, to keep them angry. here, come to school, go to college, get indoctrinated about how this country sucks. We're going to saddle you with massive debt and allow you to major in a field where you'll never be able to pay it off. Send you off into the wild, pissed off that you can't pay off your debt, not ever accepting responsibility that you made horribly stupid decisions that got you to this point, and then dangle out in front of you how it's society's fault that you have so much debt, and tell you, promise you, that government will take care of you. And that creates a whole bunch of people who are pissed off at the country because the government hasn't taken care of them yet. Those evil Republicans are stopping people from being unburdened from their student loans when they burdened themselves. So I see no way in the world that we could defeat fascism when we have so much fascism within. And that is where I want to start today. It was the great YouTube purge. Fascism is literally on the march on the 70th anniversary of D-Day. Liberal fascism. And it was a great book by Jonah Goldberg. It's not the easiest read in the world. It's not the most enjoyable read, but it is one of the most fact-packed reads you could ever engage in. Liberal Fascism by Jonah Goldberg. And by the way, I once had jury duty when I was living in Baltimore. I had jury duty quite a few times. But the first time I had jury duty, I brought Liberal Fascism with me. I had my heart. I made sure that when I was sitting in the court, that everybody could see this book. It has the cover of the smiley face with a little Hitler mustache. I wanted it to be known that, I didn't want to be picked for jury. I was there. I fulfilled my duty. If they'd have made me, they actually did make me sit on a jury that time. No, not that time. The second time I had to sit on a jury, but then they cut a plea deal after day one. But I was dismissed. I don't think the defense attorney really wanted somebody out there with my pedigree anyway, but just to put a fine point on it, I read it like a newspaper. I kind of held it up like it was a stage play. It was ridiculous. Anyway, it's a great book, and it is on the march even more so now than when Jonah wrote that book. And I say that it's not just government. It is liberalism, and liberalism infects everything. Anything that is not explicitly conservative becomes co-opted by liberalism. And in this case, it was YouTube. YouTube has decided to ban, block, and get rid of or demonetize a whole bunch of people who violate their terms of service. They're cracking the whip. Yahoo News puts it this way. YouTube announced Wednesday that it would ban videos promoting or glorifying racism and discrimination, as well as those denying well-documented violent events like the Holocaust or the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. And you hear that and you think, okay, fine, that's fine. But that's never the way that it works out. It's never just cut and dry. Here's what we're banning. Here is the line. It is nebulous and ever moving, and that's where the problem comes in, is right now you may not be the enemy, but you will soon likely find yourself being the enemy, because there are people who, if you are not them, are out to destroy you, such as the case with Vox Media, V-O-X. They employ a guy named Carlos Maza. He's gay, and he's Hispanic, so on the hierarchy of intersectionality, he's got double victimhood. He's also a little bit effeminate. God knows what else he is. I'm sure he can come up with a few more and pull a couple of rabbits out of his hat to make himself an even bigger victim. But he describes himself as, he describes himself as a Marxist pig, which I think is pretty accurate. He also writes in his Twitter bio that Tucker Carlson is a white supremacist. Isn't that nice? His Twitter handle is @gaywonk. He can go wonk himself. He's leading the charge against Steven Crowder because Steven Crowder made fun of the way that Carlos speaks. See, Carlos produces videos that are called Strike Through, where he defends things like Antifa. Oh, don't believe the hype. Antifa is just a group of people who like to gather and sip tea, and they don't attack anybody who doesn't deserve it. He really is a modern fascist. Progressives are fascists. Fascism is of the left. And let me put this to bed right now, because this is a common thing. Liberals always accuse other people of the things that they're actually doing. So when they're crying about Donald Trump as a totalitarian and he's a fascist and he's just a big old meanie and a bully and blah, 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 they're simultaneously trying to ruin people's lives. Now, I don't know what other word you could use for that other than bully. I mean, asshole comes to mind, but bully seems to work. And that while claiming that they are trying to fight fascism, and fascism, right-wing fascists, you always hear that all the time, right-wing fascists. Fascism is decidedly a philosophy of the left, as is communism, as is socialism. They are all just varying degrees of difference between the three things. It's more about who is going to be in control. If you really know the history of these groups, they always say, well, the fascists and the communists and the socialists, they were constantly clashing. Not really because their ideology was so dramatically different. It was because they wanted to all be the big dog. They all wanted to be the ones controlling the guns, controlling the power, and therefore controlling the people. It was not as though somebody in that group was like, I'm really in favor of the free market. None of them are in favor of the free market. None of them are in favor of individual freedom. They just want to be the ones holding the whip. That's the main difference, and that's why they fought. It's so simplistic. But somehow, fascism, thanks to our modern media and liberal lies and just bald-faced lies and a willingness to tell and repeat bald-faced lies, this idea is circulating amongst the populace that fascism is a product and a domain of the right. Well, fascism is about control. Socialism is about control. Communism is about control. Conservatism is about the individual liberty. How is it that you can go on the spectrum from right to left, from left to right, where left is communism and right is, if you went to the extreme on the far right, just thinking logically here, the extreme would be anarchy. You know, the size of government shrinks as it goes from left to right. So how would it then, as it crosses the middle ground, how would it then spike if somehow fascism is on the right? Yes, the further you get away from the communism of the left, the smaller government comes. And then suddenly there's this giant hiccup, looks like a heart attack on an EKG, where fascism wanting total control and dominance over everybody, and then it goes back down really small, and then it disappears when you get down to the full-blown, pure libertarian free staters on the extreme right. Just thinking logically. Of course, it doesn't make any sense because it is garbage. Hitler's platform was not all that different than, frankly, the modern-day Democratic Party platform, promising the people good things, free things, cheap things, government will take care of their problems. All of these things are inherent to the left today, as they were back then. Fascism, socialism, and communism were all different branches of the root of progressivism, the rotten root of progressivism. We defeated it in 1945. That started in earnest today, 75 years ago. But it didn't die. We didn't kill it off. It went underground. We killed the practitioners of it, but we were not able to kill the philosophy, because you cannot kill an idea, even bad ideas. And that idea metastasized, and it came to the United States like the flu in 1918. It just took a longer gestation period. It found willing homes in labor unions where it had already lived and thrived in communism form. And it found a really good, conducive environment for its growth in, sadly, education. education was perfect for it because people couldn't be fired. Once you get tenure, you can have sex in front of your class with somebody from your class, and you will be a college professor or teacher for life. It doesn't matter. Well, from there, it spread to Hollywood. From there, it spread to the media. And suddenly, you've got cancerous tumors all over our culture. And as Andrew Breitbart was famous for saying, politics is downstream from culture. You can ignore culture all you want, but you do so at your peril. So now you've got this Carlos Maza and his friends over at Vox News, and a progressive news. Calling it news is a joke. It is an affront to news. And in fact, the Washington Post wrote a story about this loser in which they called him a journalist. He's not a journalist. If you watch any of his videos, which I don't necessarily recommend, but if you happen to catch any of them, he is a violent advocate for hatred against conservatives, for attacks against conservatives. He tweeted, there's been this epidemic that was across the pond in the UK of milkshaking, throwing milkshakes at conservative politicians in public. Whenever you can get close enough to them, toss a milkshake on them. It happened here to Congressman Matt Gaetz. Well, Carlos, being the ever-tolerant man that he is, tweeted, "Milkshake them all. Humiliate them at every turn. Make them dread public organizing." Isn't that sound a little bit, well, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? Oh, yes, fascistic, because it is fascistic. Make no doubt about it. It is total and complete fascism to attack people, to try and silence people, to try and harm people, deny people their rights because of their political beliefs. This is the way that the Washington Post categorized and characterized this story. Now, keep in mind, Stephen Crowder has called this Maza guy a whole bunch of names, gay slur names. I wouldn't do it personally, but I don't care that somebody else does it because I'm a firm believer in the sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me thing. I grew up to be an adult human being. I didn't get a participation ribbon when I was a child, and if I ever had, I would have set it on fire. I either won something or I lost it. This is how the Washington Post headlines their story. A right-wing YouTuber hurled racist, homophobic taunts at a gay reporter. The company did nothing. They are actively engaging. This was before the Great Purge on YouTube. They were actively advocating for YouTube to silence people. Democracy dies in darkness is the motto of the Washington Post. Ask your bird as he craps on it. They probably noticed that on the header. I said, Carlos Maza, a video producer for the news site Vox, said the harassment began 2 years ago. In the original lead, they rewrote this. They called Carlos again a reporter. He is not a reporter. I'm more of a reporter than he is, and I am no kind of reporter. I am a commentator. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm a columnist. I am paid for my opinion. He is as well, except he is more of an activist than I am. So Stephen Crowder, a right-wing commentator and comedian, you notice how the news site Vox, Vox News is as left-wing as MSNBC is on its worst day. But the Washington Post refers to them simply as a news site. Stephen Crowder is a conservative comedian, and he is referred to as a right-wing commentator and comedian. See any bias inherent there? It goes on from there. It paints Maza as a victim, even though he had been going after conservatives. That's his job, to lie about conservatives, and he has Tucker Carlson is a white supremacist in his bio, proudly, as any good journalist would do. This guy, I really hope he gets what's coming to him. I hope it's bad. Anything bad that happens to him, he absolutely deserves. But YouTube, took heed and went on a purge. Because liberals love their purges. Just ask Stalin. Oh, they're so progressive. And YouTube demonetized Steven Crowder's videos, meaning he could not make money until he ended their offensive, horrible, mean thing. They brought his videos into compliance with their terms of service that read, essentially, you shall not be mean to any liberal for anything. You are not allowed to be funny. Funny is bad, and mean stuff will not be tolerated. But what's messed up, YouTube has kind of stepped in it here, because this is a big fight. They can win. They have more money than God. It doesn't really matter. But they could lose if somebody just had some sense and some money and built an alternate platform that ran just like YouTube, but they said, hands off, you can post any crap you want here. They would make an absolute fortune. But YouTube, in addition to going after conservatives for being mean to gay people, for making jokes about gay people, I don't think Carlos is particularly upset by any of this crap. He just gets bitchier and bitchier and bitchier. He should really be upset that he's called a journalist, but what are you going to do? Those standards have gone the way of the dodo. YouTube, in addition to that, did a great purge of anybody they deemed to have posted offensive content. And what is offensive content? Again, it falls back to if you tick off liberals. If you are conservative, if you do not adhere to what liberals want the world to be. It's kind of funny because YouTube is owned by Google. Google is one of the major funders and proponents for net neutrality. Net neutrality is the idea that all traffic on the internet should be treated equally. There should not be any control, traffic control, to make sure that things run smoothly. The internet service providers are just supposed to have dumb wires out there that provide internets to homes and not prioritize things like calls to 911. You should not be able to, if you're a bandwidth hog and say watching a whole bunch of high def YouTube videos that clogs up the internet in your neighborhood on your particular node. I don't want to get too technical here, but you should be able to do that. And internet service providers should not be allowed. They should be forbidden from selling a fast lane to websites that hog bandwidth like YouTube, because YouTube takes up a lot of bandwidth. A lot of people watching videos, streaming videos, that stuff is a bandwidth hog. YouTube doesn't want to have to pay for that. They just want the money coming in. They don't want the money going out. So YouTube is spending, and Google is spending, a lot of money to say, no, we want the internet to be a whole bunch of just dumb pipes where there's no lanes, no traffic, cops, nothing. And it's a free-for-all. And if your 911 call over VoIP doesn't get to the emergency services, hey, that's not my problem, man. Somebody was playing on their Xbox, so what are you going to do? At the same time, they want to control the content that is on their website. It's a bit hypocritical. They want free reign over somebody else's physical property, the fiber optics mostly, through which the internet is provided to people's homes. They want free reign of that, and if you dare try to charge them for hogging a lot of it, that should be against the law. But they want absolute dictatorial control over the content on their service, which is fine, because then it makes them liable for what is up there. So if you find something that is defamatory about you out there on YouTube, feel free to sue Google. They are now in charge of what is and is not acceptable content on their service. And as such, they have every right to say this is not allowed on our service. But by omission, they are saying that everything on their service is kosher with them. It's all square, man. It's square with them. That'll put them into a bit of legal jeopardy. And I think eventually, if somebody gets off their ass and puts together an actual good platform and it gets some traction, I think Google could lose some money in the long run here. But it's not just the hate. This is where YouTube goes off the rails and really shows their social justice warrior nature. It's not just people who violate their terms of service. It's people who almost violate their terms of service, which to me means that they're just redefining their terms of service. They released a statement yesterday. It said, quote, "In addition to removing videos that violate our policies, we also want to reduce the spread of content that comes right up to the line." Well, if you're removing content or downplaying content or demonetizing content, punishing people for coming up to the line, you aren't actually, you've moved the line. That's not the line. The line is you can go up to this point, but if you go past it, you've crossed the line, and therefore it is, you know, you should be punished. You've broken the rules. But if you're going to punish people for far too often going up to the line, then that's not the line. You've moved the line. YouTube doesn't seem to recognize that. What they really want is a sliding scale so they can be absolute arbiters of what is and is not acceptable speech. We see this in the Democratic Party. We see this on Facebook and Twitter. We see this on Google. We see this on YouTube. We see this everywhere on the left, because any company that is not explicitly conservative, any organization that is not explicitly conservative, will become liberal. Liberals will assimilate it. That metastasized fascism and metastasized communism, those philosophies we thought were on the ash bin of history, they are still floating in the American bloodstream, and they find willing hosts in our powerful in this country, not just politicians, but corporations. How do you defeat that? I don't know. Can you regulate that out of existence? No, you can't. We couldn't bomb it out of existence. We couldn't beat it militarily out of existence. I don't think you can regulate it out of existence. The best thing I think we can hope for is to educate it out of existence and to offer alternatives. Keep the pressure on through the market. I know this puts me at odds with a lot of people that call themselves conservatives. They want government to come in and crush their enemies. I think people have to deal with the consequences of their actions. If Steven Crowder goes begging back to YouTube and all is forgiven and he's able to get his money stream rolling again from them, then in many ways he's capitulated and he's free to do that. Even if he wins, he loses temporarily, and in the long run, YouTube makes more money off of him than he does. YouTube makes way more money off of his videos than he does. You keep feeding the beast. I get it. I would take their money too. I would hammer those checks. Absolutely. I don't blame anybody for that. Just don't get all self-righteous. Ultimately, at the end of the day, though, I think that even if Crowder wins and gets remonetized, it will change how he does his show. I've not watched his show. I've not listened to his show. I've seen a few clips here and there, and I watched a clip, Greatest Hits of the Alleged Gay Slurs, that were compiled by the so-called journalist at Vox. I wouldn't have said those things, most of those things. Some of them were kind of funny. I laughed at them because I don't care. I don't get offended by crap like that. If the problem with people like Carlos and liberals in general is that they often look externally for validation of their existence, and they're never really truly going to find it. Oh, you'll find it temporarily. Your circle of friends will high-five you or hug you or get you really excited and blah, 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 whatever, on occasion, but it's hollow. It's temporary. You have to be comfortable with who you are. You have to be comfortable with what you are. If you truly are comfortable with who and what you are, what anybody else says about you won't matter one bit. If you aren't, then you will lash out like a 3-year-old with a skinned knee and become a little whiny bitch online and demand that your enemies be destroyed and vanquished by somebody else. The problem comes in, there's always going to be, you know, people who never grow up, who throw temper tantrums constantly, who feel superior to everybody else because of things over which they had no control or just bad parenting. The problem is when those people obtain power, or people like them obtain power and use that power to impose that will on everybody else. There's a word for that. It's fascism. That's why I don't think, that's part of why I don't think we could win World War II today. We also, every civilian death would become all that is reported. That would be it. We leveled Dresden. We literally leveled Dresden. We bombed where the Nazis were and anybody who happened to be near them. We didn't say, oh no, they're too close to some houses. Some civilians might get hurt. No, it was there they are. They have to be destroyed. Let's bomb them. And we dropped those bombs. Now it is, you can't possibly engage with anybody if they're anywhere near civilians, because that would be wrong, morally wrong. No, war is to kill people, destroy your enemies. And if you're not willing to do that, don't get involved in a war. That's why we should get out of Iraq and Afghanistan. That's why we should get out of the Middle East. Not because we couldn't win there. We couldn't get our enemies to submit. It is because we won't. Because the politicians back home won't. They're too worried about what the headlines in the newspapers will say. Oh, the children. You see this in the Middle East constantly with the Israel-Palestinian conflict. Palestinians launch rockets from schools and hospitals. They surround themselves with children. They strap bombs to children. They use children as weapons and shields. And when Israel defends itself, they'll drag out a kid and say, look, Israel killed this innocent child, when there is actually no proof, and it's just as likely and possible that they simply killed the kid, because human beings, individuals, are expendable. They're propaganda tools. We don't have the will to win a war anymore. If we did, we would have been in and out of Afghanistan in about 6 months. There wouldn't be much left in Afghanistan. The mountain ranges, Tora Bora, would be reduced to nothingness. It would be leveled. It would make a great golf course by the time we're done with it if we were serious about it. But no, we had to worry about how the media would react, how it would be covered, how liberals would respond, how the social justice warrior set would respond to civilian casualties. That's the worst thing ever. You couldn't attack. And there have been times when we've had the opportunity to take out terrorist leaders, but we couldn't, and the attacks were canceled because the terrorist leader was attending a wedding or a dinner at a family's home. Well, for my money, if you're going to sit down with Osama bin Laden for dinner, I don't care if you're an insurance salesman and have never killed anybody in your life. If you are willing to dine with the devil, you get what's coming to you. You've got to expect the possibility that your house may be blown up and you be killed. You made the choice to associate with bad people. In my mind, that makes you a bad person. There are no really good people whose circle of friends are Klansmen, but they don't really subscribe to that sort of stuff. There are no really just awesome people who roll with Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. You're likely a horrible racist. Even if you aren't an official member, if you're rolling with them and you know what they stand for and you know what they are, you have to accept the consequences of that. And every once in a while, that should mean that a Tomahawk rocket drops on you when you're having dinner with a terrorist leader. But we can't do that because you know exactly what would happen. If the raid in Abbottabad that killed Osama bin Laden had gone, and the reason that they were hesitant, and the reason Joe Biden advised against it, and Barack Obama was hesitant about ordering that raid, which politically would have been suicide if he hadn't ordered that raid, so that it was a gutsy call was not a thing. It was ridiculous. But the reason he was hesitant is because, what if there are civilians in the house? And what if they accidentally kill some of those civilians? Well, if you're living in Osama bin Laden's compound, you're not really a civilian. You can feel as bad as you want to feel that if a child had been killed, but that's on the parents, not on the SEAL who put the bullet in them. It's on the parents who said, you know what? Let's go live with a guy who murdered 3,000 innocent people. He's just a misunderstood genius. I don't agree with his genocide policies. On the other hand, he makes some really good points about infrastructure. No, I'm sorry. It doesn't work that way. In World War II, if you were an associate of Hitler, you were an enemy. If you were associating with Hitler, you were an enemy. Now we have to understand the intricacies of human relationships. That is not by accident, it is by plan. It is to hamstring the U.S. military and the U.S. militarily, and it is done almost exclusively by progressives, both Republican and Democratic progressives. So, no, we could not win World War II today. We'll have more on D-Day plus 75 years in a few minutes, but I got some really cool audio that put you there at the time, in like you were living in 1944. But I want to talk about a little bit of a controversy that is surrounding Joe Biden. Again, plagiarism is plaguing Joe Biden. I am not a fan of plagiarists. I tend not to read opinion columns for the very reason that I don't want to be influenced by somebody else's opinion. I can formulate my own because I write opinion for a living. And if you didn't read it, you can't plagiarize it, even inadvertently. Joe Biden, it's not so inadvertent. His policy position papers on his website for battling climate change involved backing up a dump truck full of money and spending it on his political donors. It was couched as being very progressive and in line-ish with the Green New Deal, but the Green New Deal really is just a payoff to a bunch of lefties so that they can make sure that some of that money ends up back in the campaign coffers of other lefties. It's a lather, rinse, repeat, circle of life thing. Well, parts of it, at least five parts of it, appear to have been direct rips from liberal nonprofit think tank groups, their websites, their position papers, which is fine. That's where Joe Biden is going to get his ideas from, although you would think after, you know, almost 50 years in public service, he might have a couple of ideas of his own, but that's probably a little bit too much to ask for at his age. So they lifted it. Be fine if they had attributed, you know, people to put a footnote, or you say, according to the such and such organization, and put it in quotations, then you are absolutely fine. The problem is Joe Biden's team didn't do that. Joe Biden has a history of plagiarism. In 1987, when he was running for president, in 1988, or the 88 campaign, he had to drop out of the race because he had lifted portions of a speech by a British politician named Neil Kinnock. It was a different set of circumstances. It wasn't policy, it was autobiographical, which made it all the more weird and creepy that Joe Biden would plagiarize somebody's biography for his own. Also, at that time in 1987, another thing that made the Neil Kinnock revelations even worse for crazy sniffy Uncle Joe was the fact that Joe Biden was caught plagiarizing while in college, while in law school. Again, I've never been to law school, but I do know a thing or two about how it works, and one of the most important things that they try to impress upon you in law school is proper citation. You need to cite things properly because you are submitting legal documents under penalty of perjury. If you are citing things improperly, incorrectly, or taking credit for someone else's work, the courts tend to frown on that. So that was a double whammy for Joe Biden. That didn't get nearly as much coverage as the Neil Kinnock plagiarism, but both added to him having to step out of the race before a single vote was cast. He's been a horrible candidate every time he's run. With that in mind, you would think that his team would be extra sensitive to the idea that maybe you should, I don't know, provide credit for other people's work. You should over footnote. When I submitted the first draft of my book, I had footnoted everything I possibly could. The editors scaled it back. They said, some of it, they just said, it's redundant. You don't need to do that because, you know, you quote something three times in three pages and you don't need to actually add the footnote, whatever the case is. They're the experts. I deferred to them. Joe Biden is the captain of this ship. He, therefore, while undoubtedly probably isn't even familiar with his climate change plan, is ultimately responsible for what his campaign puts out, or should be. The captain of the Titanic could have been asleep, may well have been asleep, when it hit the iceberg. But ultimately, he is the one whose name is listed as the guy responsible for the ship sinking, because while he was in charge of the ship, it hit an iceberg. But it's different now with Joe Biden. Imagine if Donald Trump had been caught plagiarizing, lifting things from other people. Well, Democrats and the media, but I apologize for being redundant, are giving Joe kind of a pass on this one. The Politico story here about this very thing says why Joe Biden's rivals won't touch his plagiarism flap. It turns out, and this is kind of funny, if everybody's doing it, is it really plagiarism? 24 hours after Joe Biden's campaign was taken to task for lifting portions of a climate change plan without citation, it's clear that the former vice president has plenty of company. A sampling of policy proposals from Biden's leading rivals suggests the lifting of direct text from academic papers, think tanks, or policy institutes, and the cribbing of facts without attribution is fairly widespread on 2020 campaign websites. And they cite Kamala Harris and Bernie Sanders as perhaps the most egregious offenders of it. So they're all out there kind of plagiarizing, taking credit for other people's works. What's funny is, having worked in think tanks, you write those papers hoping they're cited. You put them out there for the politicians to use, for the public, for anybody to use. You want your work read. You want your work to have impact. All you got to do is acknowledge it, and you avoid any troubles. You avoid the problem. Quotation marks, a footnote, a link back, whatever it is, just give some credit and done and done. Nobody's going to say, how dare you have quoted me accurately. You should never quote me. I don't want you to quote me accurately and take my ideals seriously, you bastard. Take it down. You're never going to hear that. That's what these places exist for. It is the ultimate sign of laziness. In fact, John King on CNN surprisingly said something very similar to what I've said here just now.
Joe Biden's campaign fending off allegations of plagiarism today after revelations that the former vice president's brand new climate change policy plan copied language directly from multiple liberal activist groups and a news site. The instances circulated on social media yesterday, just hours after the plan was posted by the campaign online. The Biden campaign claiming simply a matter of some missing citations, but it was a similar allegation that helped sink Biden's 1988 presidential campaign. CNN's Arlette Sines joins us live from Manchester, New Hampshire. Arlette, forgive me here, having lived through the 87-88 campaign. This is a pretty amateur mistake for the frontrunner's campaign to make on a substantial policy rollout when they had to know, when Team Biden got together planning to announce his campaign, the one thing they cannot do is plagiarize.
Well, John, this was certainly a glitch in their rollout.
It's just a glitch, man. What are you going to do? It's just one of them glitches. Of course, the younger reporter out there on the campaign trail following Joe Biden, she's already realizing that you're not supposed to speak truth to power when the power is a Democrat. You're supposed to speak their truth. So her knee-jerk reaction is to defend Joe Biden. It's just a glitch. You know, it's a glitch in the Matrix, man. That cat going through the door twice. Just a glitch in the Matrix. What are you going to do? Maybe an agent was nearby, for those of you who know what I'm talking about. But John King, surprisingly, and another guest whose name I don't know, it doesn't matter, he had a little panel roundtable when they came back from this supposed reporter kind of trying to explain away Joe Biden's little goof. They acknowledge that he didn't have anything to do with it, but this should be a problem. Because I love how John King just says, the one thing you can't do is plagiarize. Yeah, to say the least. You can't plagiarize. Just, it's very simple. Don't plagiarize. But when they come back, John King and this other panelist had a little discussion that was interesting.
I just want to read you. This is Joe Biden in a New York Times story. We can show you the front page of the New York Times first on this day, September 18th, 1987. Mr. Biden said today, as he did 22 years ago, that he had misunderstood the rules of citation and footnoting. This is about him plagiarizing while in college. I was wrong, but I was not malevolent in any way. I did not intentionally move to mislead anybody, and I didn't. To this day, I didn't. To this day issue, that's exactly what they're saying now. I'm sorry. When this is your issue, when this has been an issue in the past, how? This is a staff issue. I'm sure the former vice president had probably nothing to do with this, but he's the leader of the organization. Hello.
Yeah, also, these days, as opposed to the 80s or 22 years before that, they have software to do this. It's quite simple to just check everything, just to be on the safe side and make sure, if you don't trust your own eyeballs, that you're not going to make this sort of a public error because somebody's going to catch it. It shows a bit of a lack of forethought, I suppose, is the polite way of saying, or, you know, I guess the worst case scenario is potentially a little bit of too much arrogance that you can just do this and not have anybody looking at you.
It's lazy or it's arrogant, and let me flip the thing. You would think he would be happy to quote progressive groups on his website as they're attacking him. He should have a great embrace.
John King is right on all counts there, and so is that other woman. Just don't do it. How hard is it to not do it? It's just like, it's not hard for me to not cheat on my wife. Look at me right now. I'm not cheating on my wife. I'm sitting here. I got a cat washing her tail just over my shoulder. I don't know if you can hear her. No, probably not. She just stopped to sniff the microphone. I'm not cheating on my wife. I'm not cheating on my taxes. I'm not out robbing banks. It's pretty easy to not do something by the simple act of not doing it. And when given the choice to do something that is wrong or do something right, it's much easier to do the right thing. It might be, you know, a little bit more work. You got to come up with your own words or add quotation marks to something you're typing, but it's not breaking rocks. They chose to do it, but fear not, ladies and gentlemen. CNN's Allison Camerota tried to justify this, tried to explain it, tried to give it a pass. And this is where the fun game of imagine if Donald Trump had done this, or imagine if any Republican had done this. Not only would this not be a non-story, which it largely has been in terms of Joe Biden, who has a history of this, that should be really damaging to him. It should be, you know, widely reported, and it's not being. But would anybody at CNN or MSNBC say what you hear Allison Camerota, a supposed journalist, say in this clip?
I will just say Chris Coons, who we had on in the first hour, had a really interesting defense to this, though, which is, come on, guys. I mean, this compared to the things that Democrats say the president is getting away with, that might be something that Democrats use to offset any potential gaffes or problems that arise during the campaign.
I mean, not only that, don't you go to the experts, to the experts' website, and lift some of their terminology and put it into your
you cite where you get your information from. Otherwise,
right.
It's plagiarism.
It's the citations.
That's what got him into trouble in the first place.
I hear you.
Allison Camerota. What's the big deal? Don't you want to go and lift and steal from all the best places? Can you imagine Donald Trump? I mean, when Donald Trump retweets somebody, some random person you never heard of, CNN has a team of people to go back through every tweet that random person nobody'd ever heard of before has ever tweeted or posted on their Facebook page, and sometimes they'll go to their homes and question them. And they hold Donald Trump responsible. Donald Trump will retweet somebody or something that is funny, and a day later, back in 2008, this person had tweeted something that was offensive about Canadians. And now, you know, Donald Trump is a Canadianophobe, or whatever the hell you would call somebody who doesn't like Canadians. I call them normal people, but that's just me. That's what happens if you're a Republican, especially a Republican named Trump. But Joe Biden ripping off people's other work. He did it, by the way, in his education platform as well. So it's not just this one little oopsie. There's a pattern yet again, and a pattern throughout his life. And Allison Camerota's going, well, that's not a big deal. And whoever that guy is at the end was right. He's like, no, you don't do that. It's plagiarism. If you don't cite it, that is plagiarism. Now, why would he say such a thing? Because that's plagiarism. They give him a pass, or they want to give him a pass. Speaking of getting passes, Nancy Pelosi, you want to talk about getting a pass. Who remembers the chance of lock her up during the campaign, right? Every time Donald Trump at a rally would mention Hillary, Diane, Rodham, Clinton Jr. III, there would be chance of lock her up. All done in good fun. Nobody was getting their pitchforks and going to track down Hillary Clinton to throw her into prison. Well, it was greeted by the media as, my God, it's just like Nuremberg all over again. These are Nazi rallies that Donald Trump is holding. You can't believe this is a threat to our very democracy, that this is what banana republics do, having somebody threaten to lock up their political opponents. It's an outrage. Well, when the tables are turned, everything is turned on its head. Like I just happened there with Joe Biden. Imagine if it were Donald Trump. We don't have to imagine in this case. Politico has this story as well. Speaker Nancy Pelosi told senior Democrats that she'd like to see President Donald Trump, quote, in prison, as she clashed with House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler in a meeting on Tuesday night over whether to launch impeachment proceedings. Isn't that lovely? Nancy Pelosi, in the midst of this argument, because they all want to go forward at different paces, Nancy Pelosi said, quote, I don't want to see him impeached. I want to see him in prison. Nancy Pelosi is a political opponent of Donald Trump. She is, in fact, the third in line for the presidency. You have the president, the vice president, then the Speaker of the House. And the third person in line for president is calling, saying that she wants to imprison the president of the United States. That silence you hear is the sound of a million journalistic pearls not being clutched. No outrage, no segments and deep thought pieces on Chris Hayes' show or Rachel Maddow about how this sort of rhetoric is a threat to our democracy. No, a fun chant at a rally is, but the Speaker of the House calling and saying she supports, she wants the president to go to prison, isn't a threat to our democracy. Of course, lost in all of this is the lack of any reason for there to be any threat of prison for the president of the United States. But pish posh, that doesn't matter. That's just semantics. Throw him away, lock him away, throw away the key, and then we'll figure out a reason for it later on. It's rather disturbing and rather disgusting if you are of the mindset that you were really very upset, as so many left-wingers told us they were, at chance of lock her up. The silence on Nancy Pelosi saying she wants to see the president in prison, well, that silence is deafening. Might I suggest that that is a bit hypocritical? Okay, enough about current days. Today is the 75th anniversary of D-Day. One of the most important days to Western civilization in all of history. And that is why the left has to pretend to care about the military. They have to pretend to give a damn. Just some interesting stats. They really don't care about D-Day. The landing, there were about 160,000 Allied troops that landed in Normandy, France. There were more than 5,000 ships used to ferry people across the English Channel. The troops were Americans, Brits, and Canadians. So I take back what I said about Canada. There were about 11,590 support aircraft. They bombed the living crap out of everything they could. Sadly, the first wave of infantry storming the beach, the planes above were supposed to bomb the Germans on the beach, but our pilots were very concerned about accidentally bombing our soldiers, and many of them missed their targets. They could have gotten the encampments and the sniper's den and machine gun dens of the Germans, but they were worried about accidentally bomb, because we didn't have laser-guided missiles back then. They just basically opened the bomb bay doors, and you look through a little viewfinder, and you kind of figure out where they're going to land. Wind could change that. So a lot of the troops on the ground faced a lot more enemy fire than they would have had we had more accurate weapons. There were 10,000 people injured, more than 4,000 people killed on this day back in 1944. Incredibly high casualty rates, but thank God it was 4,414 names of soldiers who were killed that day. And thank God they were victorious against all odds. Encampments, the Germans were right there. They were dug in. They had the high ground. They had the catbird seat. And it was through sheer force of will and determination that those heroes stormed into a beach where there was just nonstop machine gun fire at them. Some beaches, luckily, were not as heavily fortified as others, but Omaha Beach, where it seemed that the Americans' beaches were much more, a lot more fire than on some of the other beaches. And forward they pressed against all odds, against all instincts. I would think every instinct in your being would be to go in the other direction or to not get off the boat. Yet they did it. Because they believed in the cause. They wanted to fight fascism. They believed in America. I don't know that we have enough people like that anymore, and I know we don't have enough people like that anymore in politics. But I want to play a couple of historical clips to mark this. I love World War II. It's one of the subjects I've studied more than anything. When I've gone to Europe, I always make sure to go to important historical sites everywhere, but in particular World War II. First, I want to play President Roosevelt's prayer to the nation, that an address he gave to the nation the day that this news broke. People think it's weird. You know, now something happens, the president sneezes over in the UK, and you know about it instantaneously because 50 different reporters are tweeting live video feeds of it. It used to take newsreels and movie theaters before, and you know, TVs existed, or maybe TV existed, but maybe seven people had it. The way people got their news was much, much slower. They did get it through radio. And this is the President of the United States addressing the country via radio after D-Day.
My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tried by night and by day, without rest, until the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. For these men are lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters, and brothers of brave men overseas, whose thoughts and prayers are ever with them, help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in thee in this hour of great sacrifice.
Could you imagine a Democrat, any Democrat today, calling for prayer, calling on the nation to pray, when the entire Democratic Party now ridicules the concept of prayer after a tragedy? Oh, thoughts and prayers don't mean anything. Thoughts and prayers are a joke. Yeah, what a difference 75 years makes. Next and finally, I was going to play Eisenhower's note. Every soldier was given a copy of Eisenhower's note. There's audio of Eisenhower actually reading it, but I believe he did that after the fact. There was no radio address. You could not do a radio address before the attack was launched, because you never know who would be listening. You know, Germans were everywhere. Spies were everywhere. So they were handed this leaflet once they were on their ships and ready to go, with the words of Eisenhower that he later performed. But somebody in this report reads it. It's about 10 minutes long. And the reason I'm playing something that's 10 minutes long is, A, the show's already an hour. You've gotten an hour. I promise an hour every day. But it's important because this is the original NBC News report as it happened, as the news broke in the United States that the invasion of continental Europe had begun. And yes, don't send the emails. I know that we'd already invaded Italy. The point is that this was the invasion everybody knew was coming, everybody expected was coming, but nobody knew when. This was what the Germans feared most. They thought it would happen up near Calais, where we'd set up an entire fake army with inflatable tanks and jeeps to make it seem like we were going to cross over there. We even had George Patton stationed up there because the Germans were convinced that Patton would lead the invasion. Patton hated that. He actually wanted to lead the invasion, but he was more valuable as a distraction. And being a good soldier, he did what he was told. So as the invasion was happening, you can hear that the reporter is reporting the, and this is all radio, obviously, and this is how the United States found out that the invasion of Europe had begun. It's very interesting. It's a very interesting time capsule. I believe this is sometime breaking news in the wee early morning hours of, I guess it would probably still be June 6th because they're ahead of us. But they don't have confirmation, and then they get confirmation. It's also an interesting case study in how news has changed. The news business has changed. Now it would be it would be reported immediately. They would be reporting things that would be potentially harmful to our troops because they think it would be clickbait, and it would also be filled with wild speculation. What you don't hear is wild speculation in this clip, but this is in real time how the United States found out that the invasion to reclaim Europe began.
Unconfirmed by allied sources, of course, says that heavy fighting is taking place between the Germans and invasion forces on the Normandy Peninsula, about 31 miles southwest of Le Havre. Another bulletin, also from Berlin Radio and unconfirmed, says the British-American landing operations against the western coast of Europe from the sea and from the air are stretching over the entire area between Cherbourg and Le Havre, a distance of about 60 miles. I repeat, there is no confirmation. And here's another bulletin just in, DNB, the German agency says, this is unconfirmed, that the most important airdromes in the area of the Normandy Peninsula of France have been wiped out. Now, I presume that means wiped out by the Allies. As you may have heard on earlier broadcasts, all three German news agencies have begun broadcasting these stories that the invasion is here. But there is no Allied confirmation as yet. The first report came out shortly after midnight, and since then we've been flooded with reports from Berlin. Paris Radio, strangely enough, has not confirmed any of these reports. And now we have just been informed that we can expect in a very few seconds, a very important broadcast from the British capital. And so now we take you to London.
Expeditionary Force. The text of communique number one will be released to the press and radio of the United Nations in 10 seconds. Repeat, 10 seconds from now. Command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. The communique will be repeated. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. This ends the reading of communique number one from Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is New York, NBC Newsroom again. Men and women of the United States, this is a momentous hour in world history. This is the invasion of Hitler's Europe, the zero hour of the Second Front. The men of General Dwight Eisenhower are leaving their landing barges, fighting their way up the beaches into the fortress of Nazi Europe. They are moving in from the sea to attack the enemy under a mammoth cloud of fighter planes, under a ceiling of screaming shells from Allied warships. The first news flashes do not say, but a large proportion of this assault is believed to be in the hands of American men. They are making the attack side by side with the British Tommies who were bombed and blasted out of Europe at Dunkirk. Now, at this hour, they are bombing and blasting their way back again. This is the European front, once again being established in fire and blood, not only by the Americans and British, but by many allies in the fight against Axis aggression. This is the supreme test of Allied spirit and of Allied weapons. The world's greatest military undertaking is underway. Casualties in this mammoth operation, in the subsequent drive inland, may reach a dreadful toll. The German war machine is still powerful and is still strongly entrenched. Our invasion forces are on the offensive against Nazi troops who have been ordered to die rather than retreat. However, die or retreat they must, for this attack up the shores of Europe is being made with all the strength the Allied command can throw into battle. Eisenhower, the commander, has promised that his men will bring victory in Europe in 1944. The first aim of the Americans and the British will be to secure their beachheads, and then the capture or building of airfields so that our planes from European bases can carry on the task of blasting loose the enemy from his prepared positions farther back. That task now is assigned to our planes flying out of England right now. And you have already heard the flash that came from London. The flash, the official Allied announcement that the invasion of Western Europe has begun, that D-Day is here, that H hour has struck. Air power paved the way for this mighty assault from the West. Nazi targets have been hammered day and night in an offensive which has steadily grown in destructive violence. Thousands of planes each day have flown cross-channel up from Italy and Africa to tear up German gun emplacements, which have been 4 years in the making. Airfields have been knocked out of operation, and the German Air Force, with its wings very badly clipped, has been based farther and farther inland, closer and closer to the German homeland itself. Well, let me go on a little bit more. These Allied air blows were methodically driven home to prepare the way for amphibious assault.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, for a special broadcast, we take you to London, England.
Wolf. 10 seconds. Stand by. 8 seconds. 5 seconds. Stand by. 3, 2...
The following is the order of the day issued today by General Eisenhower to each individual of the Allied Expeditionary Force. Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeat in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking. This order was distributed to assault elements after their embarkation. It was read by appropriate commanders to all other troops in the Allied Expeditionary Force. I return you now to the United States.
Broadcasters, is everyone taking the official program starting at 47? This is McCall speaking. Yes.
Got a stopwatch. Click this. Stick in front of me. Good morning, everybody. We have just had the first communique from General Eisenhower's headquarters on the invasion. Here is its text. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. And we have also had the first order of the day, the one issued by General Eisenhower, wishing Godspeed to his troops as they left the shores of Britain for the shores of northern France. He told them that they were about to embark on the Great Crusade. He reminded them that the eyes of the world are upon them, that the hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere in the world are with you.
I found that horribly interesting. It's always, you know, obviously I wasn't alive then. My parents were only three at the time. But it's always, you know, you can hear, you can have interviews. There are a lot of interviews of D-Day heroes that are going to be broadcast today. I suggest you take in all of them you possibly can. If you have a chance to go to a ceremony someplace, go. If you ever have a chance to speak to a World War II veteran, do it. We are losing them at an incredible rate. This will probably be one of the last landmark anniversaries that they are still alive for. There will be some who will be around at the 80th anniversary and a few, if we're lucky, at the 85th. But 75 is a big one, and we owe them a debt of gratitude we could never repay, and we should try to repay it by still fighting the good fight. They defeated fascism physically starting on this day in 1944, but it still exists. It is on YouTube. It is in our tech companies. It is in our Democratic Party. And it needs to be called out and destroyed in every single form it possibly can be. You'll never fully defeat an idea, even a bad idea. But you can defeat it by keeping it out of power. That is what it craves. The host it has right now, it is hopefully destroying. It's just hope it destroys its host before it destroys all of us. So thank you to the soldiers 75 years ago on this day, and thank you to all of them who served. Let us all strive to be worthy of that sacrifice. At times we fall short, but we should never stop striving. We owe them that at a bare minimum. That is all the time we have for today. It went long. Tomorrow's program features a really, really cool interview with Brent Bozell about his new book, The President and Founder of the Media Research Center. It's about 40 minutes, so we'll have 20 minutes to talk before then. I know you'll like the interview, and at the end of the interview, you'll find out how you can enter to win a signed copy of his new book with Tim Graham, signed by both of them. It'll be a good time, and it'll also be Friday, which will make it a better time. God bless our veterans. 75 years ago, D-Day, let us never forget so we never have to do it again. We'll see you tomorrow.
Help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in Thee in this hour of great sacrifice.